Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Brooding Over Bloody Revenge, Enslaved Women's Lethal Resistance, by Nikki M. Taylor. Narrated by Michelle Williams. Introduction. That justice is a blind goddess is a thing to which we Black are wise. Her bandage hides two festering sores that once, perhaps, were eyes. Justice by Langston Hughes. In Clark County, Kentucky, on January 23, 1812, Peggy Daniel, the wife of Captain James Daniel, was viciously attacked in their home by Charlotte, their enslaved woman. Peggy was holding the couple's 8-month-old infant when Charlotte hit her with a block of wood. She then pushed her mistress, or female slave owner, and her baby headfirst into the fire blazing in the fireplace. According to the press, Peggy used extraordinary exertions to lift herself out of the fire, but each time Charlotte pushed her back into it until she expired in excruciating tortures. After the murder, Charlotte tried to cover the crime by running to a neighbor's home in a panic, telling them that Peggy was unwell and needed their assistance. The neighbor got dressed and followed her back to the Daniel home. Charlotte, running ahead, rushed into the house and came back out with the Daniel's baby, with its clothing still burning, exclaiming that her mistress had fallen into the fire. The papers reported that although the infant was badly burned, it survived, but Peggy's body was burnt in the most shocking manner. Because she had gone into the fire head first, her head and breast were completely incinerated. One of her arms was nearly burned into two pieces, and the other reportedly was an entire crisp. As shocking as it was, Charlotte's resistance reveals that enslaved women were not always willing to resist slavery covertly or nonviolently. Charlotte is, in fact, part of a large number of enslaved women who exercised lethal slave resistance in the United States. Charlotte confessed to the murder and was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death in Winchester, Kentucky, in February 1812. When asked by the judge if she had any reason to object to her death sentence, Charlotte, trying to save her own life, claimed to be quick with child, or pregnant, a condition that would have automatically stayed her execution in Kentucky. In response to her claim, the judge impaneled a jury of 12 women to determine whether Charlotte was indeed pregnant. That jury concluded she was not, so she was promptly hanged 5 days later on February 28, 1812. Many of the enslaved women who, like Charlotte, made the decision to kill their owners suffered the same fate, a death sentence. This book is an effort to tell the stories of these women, particularly why they made the decision to use murder as the ultimate form of resistance to slavery. Although violent resistance to slavery was not the preferred form among enslaved women, the fact that it happened at all, and despite the constant surveillance and repression women endured, is what makes these actions remarkable. This book is concerned with those moments. Few historians have made this kind of resistance the subject of monographs. Melton A. McLaurin's Celia, a Slave, and my own book, Driven Toward Madness, The Fugitive Slave Margaret Garner, and Tragedy on the Ohio, and other articles about individual women who used violence to resist slavery are rare exceptions. Without stories like the ones in this book, we are left with an incomplete, softened, or watered-down understanding of Black women's resistance to slavery. We must enrich and deepen the historiography by adding additional layers and complexity to enslaved women's resistance. It is hard to know with certainty how many enslaved women murdered their enslavers in the United States before 1865. According to David V. Baker, nearly 200 enslaved women were executed in the United States from 1681 to 1865. Most of those were executed for murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to murder whites. However, Baker's estimate may be too low. Local authorities suppressed news stories about these incidents because publicizing such crimes would seriously threaten the social, racial, and gender order. Even Charlotte's story was barely mentioned in the newspapers. Another consideration for the low estimate is the fact that in the colonial and early national eras, before the erection of separate judicial processes for enslaved people, owners resorted to their own brand of punishment, or sale. Moreover, because several southern states offered justices the option of transporting convicted enslaved murderers to another region or country as punishment, counting the executions alone misses an entire group of women who were sold and transported for their crimes. In addition to the historical, social, and cultural barriers to obtaining the exact number of enslaved women who murdered their owners or overseers, the archive has been lost, damaged, or destroyed. Many trial records about these capital cases have been lost to fire, water, and degradation, especially in the earlier eras. Other records have been simply misplaced or misfiled. Using Baker's baseline number to extrapolate, between 1681 and 1865, hundreds, possibly more than 1,000 enslaved women committed or plotted to commit deadly violence against their owners. Even with that extrapolated estimate, it must be emphasized that compared to other demographic groups, enslaved Black women were the least violent people in American society during the age of slavery. When enslaved women did sometimes murder their owners, it was not simply murder. It should be understood as slave resistance. When enslaved women did commit murder in the colonial era, 92% of their victims were white. In his study on enslaved women and capital crime in antebellum Georgia, Glenn McNair found that enslaved women targeted their enslavers or their agents for murder, including their wives and children, or overseers. They were less likely to seriously injure or harm other African Americans. He found that a higher percentage of enslaved women than enslaved men murdered their owners. According to him, enslaved men who murdered acted out of impulse or momentary anger. Women, he insists, used a higher degree of premeditation, which made them more effective resistors, ultimately. Up until now, most historians of women's history have insisted that enslaved women rarely chose armed, lethal, or overt forms of resistance. Stephanie M. H. Camp, for example, emphasized that they rejected explicit or confrontational violence in favor of covert, non-confrontational acts of everyday resistance, which include insolence, dissembling, disobedience, feigned illness, absenteeism, work slowdowns, temporarily running away, and poisoning food. Women also resisted slavery by pretending to be pregnant or claiming they suffered from debilitating menstrual issues that interfered with their work. Everyday resistance also included appropriating additional food, clothing, hair bows, or other luxury items from their unsuspecting owners. This form of resistance yielded many personal benefits, including reduced workloads, additional time off, or reassignment to different tasks. Despite the varied and creative ways enslaved women practiced everyday resistance, historians have categorized it as non-threatening and less likely to undermine or challenge the social and racial order the way a slave revolt would. Consequently, women's everyday slave resistance rarely ended in their executions, which meant it was the safer option. Not only has women's resistance to slavery been exclusively understood as this softer, everyday variety, but it also has been mischaracterized as it relates to collective and organized resistance. Historians have categorized slave revolt and uprisings as the preserve of men, leaving the impression that women rarely participated in collective, organized, violent acts of resistance. Women's participation within the histories of the major slave rebellions in the United States is not generally examined. When they are mentioned in these texts, they are relegated to the sidelines as mere witnesses or wives of the main organizers of these plots. Historians insist that the exclusion and marginalization of women was a conscious and deliberate decision made by the rebels themselves, who did not recruit women to join the front lines or leadership corps. For example, Douglas R. Egerton insists that Gabriel chose no women for the inner circle of his 1800 Richmond plot. Historian James Sidbury, trying to explain why they chose no women in the same plot, suggests that the conspirators may not have trusted Black women. Yet Gabriel's wife knew about the plot, so they clearly trusted her. Sidbury concludes that women are missing from these plots because they were planned in the masculine sphere. Historian Edward A. Pearson contends that Gullah Jack, one of the organizers of Denmark Vesey's plot in Charleston in 1822, excluded enslaved women from the rituals. These historians do acknowledge that enslaved women knew of the plots, but they portray that knowledge as accidental or even incidental. For example, the one time James Sidbury mentions Gabriel's wife Nanny in his book, he states that she tried to recruit one man for the insurrection, but adds nothing else, so we are left assuming she failed in that endeavor. Pearson claims that enslaved women in Charleston inadvertently learned of Denmark Vesey's plan. Women, he concludes, had a shadowy presence in the plot. If we take these scholars at their word, then it would seem that enslaved women hardly ever participated in revolts or, when they did, played marginal, chance, or auxiliary roles. Consequently, slave revolts have been painted as the domain of men and as uniquely revolutionary and decidedly masculine social movements. A few recent articles and books are challenging these long-standing beliefs about women's roles in slave revolts. In Surviving Southampton, African-American Women Resistance in Nat Turner's Community, historian Vanessa M. Holden offers a new way of seeing women's roles within the history of major slave revolts. Revisiting Nat Turner's rebellion, she illuminates sites, sources, and strategies of resistance previously overlooked by historians. By doing so, Holden brings women, children, and free Blacks into sharper focus. She asserts that women's gender roles often enhance the ways they could assist and do so undetected. For example, their greater mobility on the specific farms involved in that rebellion led them to play a significant role in geographies of evasion and resistance. Holden discusses how women contributed to Nat Turner's rebellion by passing information, providing shelter and sustenance, helping rebels evade authority, hiding weapons, and even physically restraining whites. The merit of Holden's book is that it reveals countless ways women assisted and collaborated in planning and executing rebellions. Brooding Over Bloody Revenge also examines collective, violent uprising, but posits that those led by women function differently than the slave revolts in which we are most familiar. Rebecca Hall's brilliant 2010 article, Not Killing Me Softly, African American Women, Slave Revolts, and Historical Constructions of Racialized Gender, and her recent gripping graphic novel Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts, engenders a problematic historiography on slave revolt that assumes women did not lead or substantively participate in them. In order to widen the lens to illuminate women who did, Hall defines revolt as any violent, coordinated act of resistance that kills or attempts to kill slave owners or their agents. Her definition, plus historian Eugene D. Genovese's concept of simple revolt, which is waged against unbearable exploitation or the overstepping of traditional arrangements, are useful. I use a combination of Hall's and Genovese's definitions to shape the contours of how I use revolt here: organized, coordinated, violent, or lethal acts of resistance that are motivated by unbearable exploitation or injustice. This definition aptly describes the actions of the women in this book. Like the women in McNair's study, the enslaved women in Brooding Over Bloody Revenge carefully premeditated and planned the deaths of their owners. These women decided when and how their owners would die, chose and secured the weapons to be used, recruited accomplices, and plotted how to evade suspicion after the murder. Because of the high degree of planning, they were remarkably efficient at completing the act, even if they eventually ended up being caught. The careful planning debunks any assumptions that these women acted out of impulse or were unjustly enraged. This book does aim to challenge the field, but that is not the only objective here. I have been led to answer a pressing and recurring question. What factors led some enslaved women to resort to deadly slave resistance? Were they motivated by similar grievances as enslaved men who planned slave revolts or insurrections? Women who murdered their owners did not have a global grievance against slavery itself, at least not one they articulated. They did not strive to end slavery or murder slave owners en masse unjustly. None of the women discussed in this book killed to secure personal or collective freedom from bondage, not one. Because protection and justice for enslaved women were elusive through traditional moral and legal channels, the only form available to them is what they seized with their own hands, a type of personal justice. Some may question whether revenge is justice. According to philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, revenge therefore belongs within the domain of justice. Personal justice or revenge, which philosopher Francis Bacon termed wild justice, is a means of restoring dignity to the victim of the initial act. Retaliatory justice is pursued outside of legal systems or jurisprudence proved to be the only kind of justice available to enslaved women. Regardless, retaliatory violence is a morally legitimate response to the injustice within slavery. The historical record includes the names of enslaved women who grabbed their own personal justice in response to wrongs done to them by their owners. Women who exercised this form of justice did so in response to beatings, abusive language, sexual assault, heavy workloads, threats of being sold away from loved ones, and being denied food, time off, and holidays. The primary way in which women's lethal resistance is different from other forms is that personal revenge and judgment were wrapped into it, a bloody indictment of their owner's cruelty and their unwillingness to take the abuse any longer. It is always nearly impossible to chart the life experiences of individual enslaved women who could not read or write. Usually, historians can only find scraps of evidence about them, numbers, dates, possibly a name, but rarely their voices or opinions, so it can be a challenging task to write about them. The white people who owned them typically are much more discoverable in the historical record. The irony of the research for this book is that these particular enslaved women are more discoverable in the archive than even the white people who owned them, about whom I could barely find their full names, ages, or other pertinent biographical information. Enslaved women who practiced deadly resistance are identified and described in official court proceedings, newspapers, and private papers. Judicial officials, ministers, and reporters made great efforts to document their verbal testimonies, confessions, and modes of execution. They even elicited the reasons these women resorted to lethal force. In other words, it is because of their lethal slave resistance that these particular Black women's voices were recorded and preserved in the archive. The archival evidence used in this book is hardly new. Court records of the women's murder trials have been used previously by other historians, but not in a full-throated examination of Black women's violent resistance to slavery. The confessions of these women and their accomplices are an essential primary source that far too few historians of women's history have examined. Found in newspapers, trial records, and coroner's inquest records, these confessions amplify Black women's voices, illuminate their motivations, and outline their plans. Corroborating evidence in the journals of the House of Burgess, compensatory slave petitions, and transcripts from the courts of Oyer and Terminer, meaning to hear and determine, State Supreme Court records, newspapers, and slave execution databases illuminate how pervasive this kind of resistance was among enslaved women throughout the history of slavery. The women in this book labored in a variety of circumstances, from rural to urban, field to house, as chattel and term slaves and hires. Just as important as their location, era, or type of bondage are the weapons they used. They used a diversity of arms: rat poison, arsenic, fire, water, axes, rusty nails, fence posts, and even a feather bed, reflecting the fact that they weaponized any household and farm item they had at their disposal when needed. Some committed face-to-face murders, while others caught their owners unaware, while they were sleeping or eating. Brooding over bloody revenge spans the entire slave era, from the colonial to the early national and antebellum eras. It examines women's overt, lethal slave resistance in the colonies of Massachusetts and North Carolina, the eastern anti-slavery states of Pennsylvania and New York, the upper South states of Kentucky and Virginia, and Texas in the Southwest. These women's criminal cases offer a treasure trove of information about them as women and enslaved people, society, the judicial systems, and the very meaning of justice. Enslaved women's sense of injustice and justice has rarely been examined. In this book, enslaved women's ideas about justice are juxtaposed against how justice was defined by white local leaders and how it was codified and enforced within the judicial systems. Those clashing and conflicting ideas about justice are revealing. These resistors are presented in their specific local contexts because they were bound by local slave and criminal codes and justice systems, which varied across time and space. Some states even erected separate laws, judicial systems, and processes for enslaved people. Hence, this book will examine multiple legal contexts. My argument is simple. Enslaved women did, in fact, resist slavery with deadly violence, and when they did, their own ideas about injustice were a central motivation. It is no surprise that injustice would be at the center of my argument, because as Eugene D. Genovese declares in his seminal text, violent confrontation with injustice lay at the core of any revolt against slavery. I agree. The enslaved women who committed thoughtful, coordinated, confrontational acts of violent resistance did so within these smaller, local plots of revenge against their own owners. I examine enslaved women's lethal resistance within a framework of a Black feminist practice of justice. I term it a Black feminist practice of justice, as opposed to simply a Black practice of justice, not because these enslaved women were Black feminists themselves, they were not, but because this theory is rooted in the tenets of Black feminist thought. First and foremost, Black feminist thought prioritizes Black women's voices and lived experiences, which deepens our understanding of and appreciation for them as historical agents. Secondly, this theory appreciates that Black women's relationships to their families and communities reign supreme and dictate much of what they feel and do. In other words, Black feminist thought is a community-centered perspective. A significant feature of Black feminist thought is intersectionality, or the idea that the racial, gender, and class/status oppressions that determine Black women's lived experiences and relationship to power are interlinked and intersectional. Black feminist thought seeks collective psychological liberation as a goal. Finally, it insists on respecting Black women's and Black people's humanity. A Black feminist practice of justice emerges from a Black feminist philosophy of justice. Enslaved women's philosophy of justice was practical and boiled down to a sense of fairness, decency, justness, and humane treatment. A Black feminist practice of justice has, at its roots, a basic understanding that justice must be centered on the idea of fairness and the humane treatment of all people, regardless of race or status. Any failure to honor that basic premise is itself an act of injustice. Chattel slavery is the biggest example, but other smaller acts of inhumanity also are evidence of injustice, such as sexual assault, denying people adequate food as a form of punishment, or disrespectful name-calling of women in front of their children. Like all Black feminist theoretical approaches, a Black feminist practice of justice is formed from Black women's lived experiences. It prioritizes their perspectives and values, which, in turn, shape the tenets of this theory. Such a theory takes into account how the intersectionality of their oppression as women, African Americans, and enslaved people made them less likely to obtain legitimate forms of justice in response to abuse, mistreatment, and suffering, and consequently, more likely to seize it with their own hands. This philosophy insists that the American judicial system was constructed within the context of slavery and never made justice or redress for Black women a goal. It appreciates that they had few legitimate advocates or defenders within that system or in society in general. It is in that context that Black women's own brand of retributive justice is born. The irony is that the enslaved women who practiced retributive justice often were condemned and doomed to death sentences, which had retribution as a primary goal. People would be remiss to conclude that Black women who waged lethal resistance to slavery were irrational, acting purely on emotions. To the contrary, one of the core features of a Black feminist practice of justice is its rationality and forethought. Enslaved women who used lethal violence against their owners were neither impulsive nor irrational. They carefully planned every detail of the murders they committed. Those who marshaled their own justice, in the chapters that follow, had very personal and compelling reasons for murdering their owners, which they usually articulated. They planned these crimes for days, weeks, months, even years in advance. In the course of plotting, they recruited other hands when needed, delegated responsibilities, decided which weapon would be used and who would wield it. They also predetermined the day and time of the fatal attack and orchestrated fairly sophisticated plans to escape or avoid suspicion afterwards. Some even came up with complex plans to avoid or delay their executions, as Charlotte did. The plots these women masterminded and organized should be considered intellectual acts. Retaliatory violence must be understood against the backdrop of the injustice the women experienced at the hands of their owners and within social, religious, and legal systems. It must be understood against the backdrop of how their owners treated them. In that vein, these Black women's ideas of justice were local and homegrown. They did not believe it was wrong to do harm to evil people who had hurt them or their families. To the contrary, for them, doing so was a kind of justice. Deadly violence within a Black feminist practice of justice is not the first or even second option to deal with unjust peoples or systems. It is often the last resort when other options to alleviate injustice, unfairness, abuse, and suffering have been exhausted. Every woman featured in this study tried other forms of resistance before they resorted to lethal violence, including talking back, running away, asking to be sold, or physically assaulting their owners. They used deadly violence only after other forms of resistance to obtain relief had been exhausted. For the women featured in this book, lethal violence was their last best option. On first glimpse, it may seem that the enslaved women in this book exercised little restraint in how they murdered their owners. The bludgeonings they delivered often seem out of proportion when compared to the abuse their owners unleashed. These critiques invoke the ancient concept of just deserts, pronounced like desserts, or people getting the punishment they deserve, which is a cornerstone of how judicial systems try to obtain justice. More commonly recognized as an eye for an eye, the law of just deserts, can be found in the Hammurabi Code, biblical law, Islamic law, and philosophy. More importantly, the concept of
sample complete. Ready to continue?